Oh, now it's going.
See the red light steady.
Oh, it has to.
Breakthrough.
Let's just start that over again.
No, just go ahead.
You can cut that off after? The red light has to be steady. Yes. Not flickering. Even though the little lines are going. Okay, here we go. Back into Vimalakirti's sick room we all go. I don't think there's anybody here who's brand new who hasn't already visited the Vimalakirti sick room, right? At this point, so we all know where we are. We're in the Vimalakirti's boundless sick room with all the other suffering beings in the world. And we've been spending a lot of time here in these weeks, and I hope you have, you know, been kind of visiting Vimalakirti's sick room in your daily life as well, you know, in a kind of conscious way now and then, realizing that's where you are. It's where we all are. In the company of countless beings. And we've been all listening in to quite a remarkable Q&A session between Vimalakirti and any number of colorful characters in this sutra. Way more than 20 questions. Is it 20 or 21 questions? You know that guessing game?
I think there's two different games. One's 20 and one's 21.
No wonder I was confused. Anyway, there's way more than that in this sutra. I'll bet if you counted all the questions, it would be over 100, maybe more. On Sunday, Claire gave quite a wonderful talk about Chapter 8, which is called The Buddha Way, which focuses on three important questions. And they're such good questions that I think it's worth giving a little further consideration to them. How many were here on Sunday? Not that many. A few. So it might be a little redundant, but it bears review. And really personal reflection. So I thought we'd, you know, give some time to that today. And the first question in this chapter comes from Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And he asks Vimalakirti how one masters the Buddha way. You know, master is a bit of an intimidating word, of course. So we could also say, how does one even follow the Buddha way? And Vimalakirti replies that you follow a way that is not the Buddha way. Right, completely paradoxical answer. And Manjushri is suitably baffled. Like, what? Follow the way that isn't the way? What is he talking about? Doesn't make sense. And yet it's one of the most fundamental paradoxes of Zen practice. And it often comes up in the classical Zen koan dialogues. Perhaps the most well-known being this one, which Claire referenced, the monk Zhao Zhou. And this one, if you've ever been to a practice period where we've had a shuso, a head monk for the practice period, the end of the practice period, the shuso does a kind of question and answer ceremony, right? Questions and answers are big in Zen. And at the beginning of the ceremony, the shuso recites this koan, which goes, the monk Zhao Zhou asked his teacher Nan Chuan, what is the way? And Nan Chuan replied, everyday mind is the way. Zhao Zhou asked, how should I direct myself toward it? Nan Chuan replied, if you direct yourself toward it, you will be going in the wrong direction. Zhao Zhou said, but if I don't direct myself toward it, how can I know it? You know, like, I need a goal. I need a direction. And Nan Chuan said, the way has nothing to do with knowing and not knowing. Knowing is an exaggeration. Not knowing is stupidity. If you're attached to knowing, you're probably going to exaggerate. And if you're attached to not knowing, you might not pay attention to what needs to be done right in front of you. When you enter the way, you see it as vast and boundless as space. What does this have to do with yes and no thinking? So that was his reply. And then, of course, the koan says, Zhaozhou suddenly realized Nanchuan's meaning for himself. So it's this old paradox that if we strive and strain and try and get something they think of as enlightenment, we'll just get in our own way. Always disappointed, always frustrated with our own failures or the failures of others to support us in the way we think they should. And all the while, Buddha nature pervades every moment, every place of our life, right here and now. Our everyday life. And this is where the expression everyday Zen comes from. Everyday Zen is the title of a kind of modern-day classic by Charlotte Joko Beck, one of the early, relatively early books about Zen by Western teachers. And of course, our teacher, our Mountain Rain's founding teacher, Norman Fisher, took Everyday Zen as the name of the foundation that he started after he completed his tenure as abbot at San Francisco Zen Center, the Everyday Zen Foundation. That's where the Everyday Zen phrase comes from, that koan. But we can see how Vimalakirti, or Vimalakirti Sutra, set forth this view hundreds of years before Nanchuan expressed it in China. This is like the roots of that Mahayana perspective, the Bodhisattva perspective. So here's how Vimalakirti replies to Manjushri. And in the text that we've been using, the bodhisattva is always he. Bodhisattva. And so I've changed it. Bodhisattvas show greed and desire in their actions, yet are removed from the stains of attachment. And they show anger in their actions, yet have no anger or aversion toward living beings. They appear to be stupid, but utilize wisdom to regulate the mind. They appear stingy and grasping, yet relinquish both inner and outer possessions, begrudging neither body nor life. They appear to break the precepts, but in fact reside secure in the pure precepts, and even then remain mindful of committing the smallest harm. And it goes on and on. I might give you a few more quotes. But the gist is the bodhisattvas live as ordinary, flawed, fallible human beings, not turning away from any of the painful or unpleasant manifestations of human life, either within or around us. They seem angry and irascible, yet are at all times compassionate, forbearing and forbearing, indolent and lazy, yet work diligently to acquire merit, seem disordered in thought, yet constantly practice meditation, seem stupid, yet have mastered both worldly and otherworldly wisdom, appear fawning and deceitful, but use skillful means well, appear haughty and arrogant, yet serve as a bridge and a crossing for living beings, appear to be immersed in earthly desires, but their mind is at all times clear and pure. Well, how could that be? Hmm. Right? Sounds nonsensical. And yet, what it's saying is that when aversive states arise in us and we see them clearly and release them so that they do not harm others, we are able to be in the world in with those arising, karmic arisings, without, you know the expression karmic outflow, right? It's the what flows outward from everything we do or say, right? And so the harmful outflow, you know, we can have states arise in us without contributing to harmful outflow. I think that's what he's describing here. And it also, this section recalls to me an earlier section, I think it's in the second chapter, where there's a description of Vimalakirti, of how he goes everywhere, from gambling parlors to government offices and courts of law, meeting the rich and the poor, the famous and the infamous, with kindness and patience and equanimity, offering the Dharma to all. So he can travel through all these realms of existence, and both inner and outer. So we can travel through, you know, those six realms, the human, the hungry ghost, the hell realms, the animal realms, the asura. The asura are the type A individuals. The competitive, always got to be better than the next person. And the heavenly realms, we can travel through those realms in our world and in ourselves. We can, and our practice supports this. You can practice this in your zazen, because that's when things slow down enough that, I mean, you can't do it, you're just sitting here, right? Actually, nothing's happening. And something, a little worry or a little memory or something just arises in the mind, right? And then the cascade begins, right? Of feelings and thoughts and dialogues, and we can watch that arise. You know, we can feel it. We can feel whether it's anger, you know, because that we remembered that what that person said, and like a little volcano starts up, and we can feel it. But we're just sitting here; nothing's actually happening in the Zendo. So we just stay with it. We stay with it without trying to micromanage it, or just with this witnessing mind. And it arises, and we see what the mind does and the body does, and then we see it subside. We feel it subside. And then it's gone. It's just there it was, and now it's gone. So we can really practice with this in our zazen, particularly if we do longer sesshin, because you don't have much choice. You're stuck there, right? You're stuck there with your body and your mind. And you can really experience these arisings and passings and how both utterly real and utterly insubstantial they are. The reality is only in that momentary, constantly shifting arising. And that really helps us then in our daily life to take that little backward step of awareness, and to whatever extent we're able, reduce those karmic outflows of harmful speech and harmful behavior, and to whatever extent we're able, to make a little bit of difference, the small or large differences to others in the way and around us. And that's, it's just basically daily life, but that's the bodhisattva path, and that's what I believe really is being said here. So that's the first question. What was it? how does one master the Buddha way? How does one follow the Buddha way? And the answer is by not following the Buddha way. by following, it's not the Buddha way, and in other words, paying attention to the messy life that we have. So the next question, so Manjushri obviously has to have a follow-up to that. And Manjushri asks, what are the seeds of enlightenment? What are the seeds of liberation from this messy world of suffering? And so you might think that the seeds of enlightenment would be all the virtues that we aspire to cultivate, patience, wisdom, kindness, all those good things. But again, Vimalakirti gives a paradoxical answer. He says, the body is the seed. Ignorance and partiality, grasping, you know, we want what we want and we don't want what we don't want, are the seeds. Greed, hatred, and ignorance are the seeds. The four topsy-turvy views are the seeds, which I did not look up, sorry. This is a list of the five hindrances. We know what the five hindrances are, right? You want a refresher? Okay, these are the classic five hindrances. You can all make your personal list. Grasping, aversion, agitation, sluggishness, and doubt. So there's two pairs, grasping and aversion, agitation, anxiety, and sluggishness, often called sloth and torpor. And doubt, which is, of course, a big one. But you could add others. You could add envy. You could add what? Yeah. Any number of hindrances. Hindrances being states that cloud our clear mind. Right? So they're seeds of awakening, Vimalakirti is saying. Those very hindrances are seeds of awakening. The six senses, the seven abodes of consciousness, the eight errors. I didn't look those up either. The nine sources of anxiety, I should look that up. But the point is, these are all the states that plague us, right? That we want to get rid of. Then he's saying, these are the seeds of awakening. And then he says, to sum it up, the 62 erroneous views and all the different kinds of earthly desires are all the seeds of the Buddha. So don't worry about all the numbers and lists. The point is that our very flaws and failings and frustrations are the seeds of awakening. That's what he's saying. If we pay attention to them rather than turning away and see them as arising and passing results of myriad causes and conditions beyond what we can ever even understand, some we understand, some we don't, we can attend to these seeds with patience and kindness. And these are the very, these ways that we suffer are what open us also to compassion for others who are suffering as well. And they're what open our hearts and minds. And if we didn't have them, we couldn't open our hearts and minds. We'd just be up in that heavenly realm, kind of laying around, eating peaches. And then comes what to me is one of the most beautiful passages in this sutra. The lotus does not grow on the upland plain. The lotus grows in the mud and mire of a damp, low-lying place. It is only when living beings are in the midst of the mire of earthly desires that they turn to the Buddha Dharma. If you plant seeds in the sky, they will never grow. Only when you plant them in well-fertilized soil can they sprout and flourish. So there's the gardening metaphor. So, of course, I love this passage. The lotus of the unclouded mind, the awakened mind, grows right from the mucky mess of our lives. So that's the second question. What are the seeds of enlightenment, of awakening? Third question comes from a bodhisattva named Universally Manifested Physical Body. What a name. Universally Manifested Physical Body steps up and asked Vimalakirti, "Laymen, your father and mother, wife and children, relatives, retainers, clerks, people and friends, who are they? Your maids and men servants, your elephants, horses and carriages, where are they?" So I love this bodhisattva's name, universally man-assisted physical body. This bodhisattva is a living, breathing, vulnerable, embodied bodhisattva, just like us, subject to sickness, old age, and death. And that very body is universally manifested. Is this true of our embodied existence too? Maybe so, huh? Maybe so. And this bodhisattva is asking about all the connections of a layperson's life, not a monk, of a layperson's life. He's asking about our family, our bicycles, the food we eat, our dogs and cats, our friends, our workplace, our work colleagues. Who are they? Where are they? Our elephants and carriages. All the things that, from the perspective of a monastic life, are seen as encumbrances, as of attachments and entanglements. So, what do you think Vimalakirti says? Not what you might expect. Wisdom is the bodhisattva's mother. Skillful means is his father. Of those who guide and teach all beings, there are none not born of these. So, of my wisdom and skillful means are what births us as bodhisattvas. Dharma joy is his wife. Pity and compassion of mind are his daughters. Or we could say Dharma joy is his lover. Pity and compassion are his children. The good mind and sincerity are his children. Final emptiness and tranquility, her dwelling. For disciples, he has many dusts and passions. They follow the dictates of his will. The 37 elements of the way are her good friends. Through them, she gains correct enlightenment. The paramitas are their dharma companions. The four methods of winning others, their singing girls, etc., etc. So all these I don't think here he's saying that all the people and objects of our ordinary lives must be replaced by all these Dharma practices and teachings. What I think he's saying is that when we live our ordinary lives in the light of the Dharma, those very relationships to the people and the stuff of our lives are transformed by the light of the Dharma, by seeing with our Dharma eye. So we expand our capacity to be in relationship with ourselves and others in the world around us without grasping or pushing away, able to respond to changing conditions with the skillful means of Vimalakirti. And that's a pretty profound teaching, really. You know, that we can live in this world as ordinary people with all those complications in a way where they are transformed by the wisdom and compassion and skillful means of the Dharma, of our practice. Not by some great magic, but in whatever small increments, in whatever ways, it makes a difference. So I just wanted to set out those three questions for you. And now I want to give you a chance to do some personal reflection on that. And before I put you into groups, because these aren't easy questions, I want to encourage you to take a piece of paper and a pen. Let's pass these around. And if somebody, there's a stack of magazines in there, if people want something to write on. And folks on Zoom, if you have some writing materials handy, please take a moment to get them. And then I'm going to just reword these questions for you in a way to help you do some reflection on them. Yeah, if anybody wants a magazine to give you something firm to write on, besides the floor. Okay, we're almost ready. Zoom folks, are you prepared? Got something to write with? Okay, good. Okay, first question. Think of an example of how sometimes when you point yourself in one direction, you get in your own way. If you point yourself, say, like too narrowly in one direction, you get in your own way. What does it mean to you to follow the way that is not the Buddha way? And using an example might help.
Would you repeat this?
Yeah, think of an example. You know how Vimalakirti said the way to follow the Buddha way is to follow the way that is not the Buddha way. You know, so be angry, but still have a kind heart. Or be so. Think of an example of how sometimes if you point yourself or you try to aim too hard in one direction, you actually end up getting in your own way. That might help. Or how does that help you kind of wake up to, oh, wait a minute. I need to open this up. Okay, that's your first one. So I'll just give you a few minutes to see what you come up with. Maybe you were trying so hard to get a particular goal or what you wanted, and then it just caused you more trouble. Okay, so don't worry, you don't have to tell the whole story, but this is just make some notes for yourself. So when we get into small groups, you'll have something to go on. Second one, think of an example of a seed of awakening in your own life, an experience of hardship or suffering that opened your heart and mind to a wider view of the world, of Buddha Dharma, of suffering. So a muddy place that gave rise to a lotus. Some experience of hardship or suffering that opened your heart and mind, where there was a turning, an opening, a seed of awakening. And one more. This is the question from the Bodhisattva of universally manifested physical body. This is that Bodhisattva's question. Think of a relationship in your life, and it could be to a person, but it could also be to you, a job or a physical object or tool or a relationship in your life that has been or could be transformed by the Dharma perspective, by seeing it with your Dharma eye, that relationship. That has been transformed or could be transformed by seeing that relationship with your Dharma eye.
Could you reiterate what seeing with the Dharma eye means?
Well, Dharma eye sees that everything is impermanent and not all self-reference, that we are not the center of the world and that we are interconnected with everything. Not a separate self. Dharma eye is also Dharma ears, the eyes and ears of Kanon Bodhisattva of compassion. And so there's the eyes of wisdom and the eyes of compassion. Those are Dharma eyes too. How does that view transform a relationship?